Have you ever been in court? I mean, a real court? Have you ever had to go in and face a judge? Whatever the situation might have been. You know, I had to stand before the judge. I had to answer to, yes, Your Honor. No, Your Honor. Yes, I was going 77 miles an hour. Or whatever it was. I don't remember. That's been 40 years ago, but I did it. I remember that. Or maybe you've been party to some civil or criminal court. Maybe you've been on a jury and seen court from the inside that way. And it's fascinating to just go, if you will, sit in the bleachers and watch court proceedings as an observer. Because you will see, you will experience, you will hear some very sobering, sometimes some strange and upsetting things in courtrooms. It is a different atmosphere. It's a serious, no-nonsense proceeding, or at least it's supposed to be, it should be, no-nonsense. Unfortunately, there's little fear of God in so much of our society anymore, and it infects our courts as well. But we, as God's people, we see the justice system, not only in this nation, but all around the world, getting as twisted away from its roots and purpose as the rest of society. But I ask, might you have to face one of those courts? My title today is Your Day in Court. Your day in court. In the end times, we expect hatred. We expect persecution. We see it for some of God's people already, very vehement. You know, Jesus Christ in Matthew 24, he says that many will be offended and they will betray one another and they will hate you. Many will be offended that we stand for righteousness. It's the world that's offended against us because we have moral standards that we want to retain, that we want to live by. And they hate those things, and they hate us for it. Jesus Christ in John chapter 15 also said, if the world hates you, just know this, that before it hated you, it hated me. Today we see speech and even the freedom to speak out in any kind of dissent is being canceled, if you will. Cancel culture. Cancel speech. If you do speak out, they label it. They want to put some label on it to demean it, to cancel it. If it's hate speech, whatever they want to term it as. Sometimes it's being actually literally denied, where people are having their accounts taken off of social media. There's an article that just came out a couple weeks ago in some of the news sources that I watch, WorldNet Daily and some of the other places, just for headlines. But this was interesting. It's about some parents back east in the United States who had to stand up and say, hey, we're not domestic terrorists. Just because we go to a school board meeting and complain about what's going on in the schools, but they're being labeled and being investigated by the U.S. government and its agencies as, quote, domestic terrorists because they're standing up against what establishments are doing. It's an interesting article. I won't read from it. But this article's only 2 weeks old. And then there's an article also about a minister. And this is just across the border in Canada. We like to think of Canadians as brothers in our way of thinking, but they're not always. We know that they're much more socialist than we are yet. But up there, there was a preacher who decided he was going to have church meetings in spite of government mandates and requirements. And so they threw him in jail recently. Pastor Artur Pawlowski, he's from Poland. He fled from Poland when he was a youth and the Russian domination of Poland. So he had some experience with what they call show courts over there, which they say the object of the show court in Poland at that time under the communist rule was to show the people that the government and the courts can do what they want to whomever they want, and there's no recourse. So here Mr. Pawlowski went to jail, got out, and the judge that put him in jail says, okay, you're out, you get a fine, you get community service. One more thing. Here's a script. Anytime you speak, you will say these words. And he gave him a script that he has to read when he speaks publicly, including in church. Now, I know that's Canada, and I know it's one instance, but it is an example of what God's people, or those who try to live a godly life, are facing. It's sobering. What to say that you have to give, quote, the other side of the story, what the experts are saying. The judge says, it doesn't matter what you feel, you have to tell them what, quote, the experts have to say about. So the courts are becoming more politicized. We see that in our news media. They're becoming very culturally progressive. But let's not speculate. I have no idea. We don't know if any of us will face a court like that. And it's true. We don't know if any of us will get caught in their spider web, if you will. But those webs are being spun all around us, even out here in our little area. But Daniel forewarned us. Let's turn to Daniel in chapter 7. We'll spend a lot of time in Daniel today, so after we're here for a little bit, we'll go elsewhere and then we'll be back. But Daniel chapter 7, Daniel forewarned us about this. Daniel chapter 7, where he's talking about the vision of the four beasts. In verse 2, Daniel spoke, saying, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. So there's some spiritual upheaval going on that's stirring up the masses, churning up the great sea, stirring things. There's a spirit that's upsetting masses of people today, and we see that very clearly. Verse 7, this is interesting. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast. So he's described the others. And we know this fourth beast fits in with end time prophecies and what's going on. A fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and exceedingly strong, and it had huge iron teeth, and it was devouring and breaking in pieces and trampling. And we see culture and history, righteousness being trampled, terrorized, breaking it in pieces, trampling the residue with its feet. But it was different from all the beasts that had been before it. And it had 10 horns. Different. I think you'll see that the old King James says it was diverse. It was unnatural. As unnatural as the other beasts, this was more unnatural than all that was previous. If you will, it was altered, even perverse, that beast. Verse 8, we see that it was speaking pompous words from its mouth. That sounds like today. Verse 21, some of the points about it. It makes war with the saints and it prevails against them. You know, that's you and me. That's God's people. Verse 25. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High and persecute the saints of the Most High, shall intend to change times and law, and the saints shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. Dreadful things that are in the future. How near future? We don't really know. Intense persecution, some are feeling. I think we're yet to see that. We expect to face and to stand firm, don't we? If we face these things, our intention here now today is to stand firm against it, to be strong against this system, against its power, against its perverse nature, even against the terror described in that scripture. Are we prepared to stand? Proverbs 16:1. Today's the 16th proverb was in my daily reading. 16:1 says, "The preparations of the heart belong to man." There are responsibility to prepare our hearts. "But the answer of the tongue is of God." I think in a courtroom especially, we want the answer of our tongue to be God's response and not our personal, whether we're scared. What might you be? What might you be in court facing a situation like this? Are we prepared to stand and to stand strong? Again, I can't speculate on who might face a perverse court, or some angry judge. I don't know. But let's do look today at a real case in American history about religious freedom. And let's look at some of the lessons that are helpful to us. Even if we never see a court, things for us to consider, because we're all, if you will, in the court of our own daily examination of ourselves and the court of what the public sees our lives to be like or the brethren around us. We're all being watched. So this was in the early 1970s. This issue was decided the year that I started as a senior in high school in 1972. And it went clear to the Supreme Court of the United States that SCOTUS, they shortened it to SCOTUS, the Supreme Court of the United States. And it was titled Wisconsin versus Yoder. And there were actually three families, the Yoder family and a couple others. And they were Amish families. And what they had done is they had their children in the public schools until the eighth grade. And then because of their religious beliefs and their religious practices, when the children graduated, finished the eighth grade, they were teenagers, then the Amish people took them out of the public schools. They had their own system within their community on how they continued to train up their children. They took that responsibility to themselves. But Wisconsin says, you can't do that. And Mr. Yoder and the other says, well, sorry, we're not sending our kids to your schools anymore. And of course, the state threatened him, are you going to go to jail? Or your wife's going to go to jail and we'll take your kids away from you? Mr. Yoder says, no. Just no. He just said no. Now this, the things that I'll be looking at today that we'll be talking about is from a talk by an attorney. His name was David Gibbs, and he worked with the Christian Liberty Academy of Satellite Schools, a group back east that had alternate religious schooling because they were concerned about public schools. And the title of his talk or his instruction was Convictions versus Preferences. And I found, well, Evelyn and I, we came across this material. It was a cassette tape we received from some homeschool meeting. And we found it thought-provoking, very thought-provoking. Back in the homeschool days in our house, and I researched this court case, found it online, read through not all of it word by word, but a lot of it. They call it a court opinion, and I think that is an appropriate word, opinion. I understand they look at it different than we look at it. But I looked at that, and I said, okay, I understand. And the court made an ultimate judgment. See, Mr. Yoder went to the local court, and he lost. And so he appealed it to the state Supreme Court, and he lost. He still stood firm. He was still adamant on what his religious convictions required of him. And he went to the Supreme Court. I don't know how long that process took, but the Supreme Court had it in hand for 6 months and then delivered their opinion and said, Mr. Yoder, you are right. You don't have to send your children to that Wisconsin school. the First Amendment of the United States Constitution protects you. And they laid down the foundation for a lot of the religious freedoms over the years. That was 50 years ago. Unfortunately, that is the same Supreme Court that more recently has struck down in saying that the Ten Commandments can't be posted in public schools, that there's no mix to be made of those kind of things. And they've taken out they've made it clear that they're descending on the same ladder to the bottom of the well, if you will, as society all around it. In many ways. Now, sometimes they stand up, but in many ways they're on that downward trend. But convictions versus preferences. So it brings up in our minds, what are our beliefs? What are your personal beliefs that you will stand for? And which of your personal beliefs are one that, well, I think so, but I'm really not confident, or I'm willing to be flexible? How can you define and defend your convictions, your absolute beliefs? And I think it's a story for each of us to consider. Because the Supreme Court, this court, in this instance, as in most court cases, the court controlled the arguments, controlled the proceedings. And so to begin with, they started by defining terms. They controlled what the terminology meant. And first they defined, well, they said, and by our definitions of terminology, we will base our judgment based on our terminology and not yours. It's just something to consider in this world. And so we see that in the media. We see it around us in many ways. The first thing they said, that a church, we consider ourselves the church of God. But there are many that look at church as a building they go to. So they said the church is not a building. It's not a corporation or organization. It's not a system of practices, you know, what we do as a group, as people. They said that a church is a matter of beliefs and the believers that subscribe to those beliefs. That makes you and me. We are the church because we have a set of beliefs, we know the origin of them, and we subscribe to those beliefs. So it fits Scripture. That we have no argument with that. And much of what the court found in this whole case are agreeable with Scripture. However, the court said that you can't hold a belief if you cannot describe it. You personally have to be able to describe your belief, to verbalize it, to make it oral and understandable so that they know what it is that your argument is if you're in the court. What it is that you're asking to be protected by the Constitution of the United States. They said it's not a feeling. It's not a hunch. It's not a, well, it seems to me like this is what I should be doing. It seems to me this is what everybody else is doing. They said, can you clearly describe your beliefs? Because the court wants specifics. I think that's a reasonable expectation. So, at that time, that court asserted that only religious convictions are protected by the Constitution. And so, we're familiar with the First Amendment of the Constitution. It was in the notes of that case, Wisconsin versus Yoder. The First Amendment, and they put it in the notes, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. But they said that religion has to do with a church, which is a matter of beliefs and the believers that subscribe to it. So they got very specific, but I think God's pretty specific, and we want to be too. We want to be clear about what it is that we are living by, what we're standing for. So the court requires us to verbalize our beliefs, have a clear knowledge and an accurate understanding of what those beliefs are. You see, they clarified very clearly their definitions, and so they expected the same from anyone who wanted respect in the church. In the court, if you want respect and support from the court, then we need to be able to clarify our definitions because they expect the same from us. And we want to get, of course, our definitions from a reliable source, not I feel like or I think, but back to it is written. The Lord said, well, we can all find a common foundation. See, the court says you can't stand on, quote, I'm a Christian. If you want to stand on that, the court's going to ask, okay, what does that mean to you? Not to the world. What does it mean to you if you say, well, I'm a Christian, so I can't do this? They wanted specifics. They want a definition and a description and the basis for your terminology, just like they clarified their terminology. They either want to see that you know what it means and where do you get it from. Do you just get it? Well, my family grew up in the church, and so my family's got to be right, so I just do what they do. I think I believe what they believe. I think so. Or do you get it from your friends? Because I like to be around this bunch of people, and I want to get along with them, so I need to do and act like them and espouse the same thing. Or do you get it from some preacher that's very persuasive and a very good teacher? Or, again, it is written. That's where our foundation is. We understand that. And so Mr. Yoder started in the local court and lost, but he didn't give up. He appealed and he lost, but he didn't give up. He finally made it to the Supreme Court of the United States, and they said, Mr. Yoder, you don't have to send your teenagers to Wisconsin schools because the First Amendment says you don't have to. You know, that was I'm sure that was really good news. Now, we understand there's lots of different kinds of good news, but I would imagine, I can't conceive of what it cost those men, those three families, to go that far through the court system. It's always with this sword hanging over their head that if you lose, you're going to jail and we're taking your kids. But they stood firm. So we see first that the court defined terms and expected the same. The second point that was really powerful is that in the deciding of such cases, the court found that they needed a test. How do we test your beliefs? You say it's a conviction. How do you know and how can you show to us that it is a conviction? You see, Mr. Yoder lost and then he lost. But he still said, if you will, it doesn't matter to me if a court says I'm right or if a court says I'm wrong, I'm not going to send my kids to your school because of my religious conviction and our religious practices based on those convictions. I'm sticking to my decision because, court, you're just going to give me your opinion. But I have a concrete foundation I'm standing on. Mr. Yoder stayed there, even though he was threatened with all those things. Well, the court found his persistence admirable, and I think we would too, but a very little influence on their decision. Persistence is a good thing. God says we need to persist, and it took persistence by Mr. Yoder and those with him to get to a point of a good opinion, but it wasn't their persistence that swayed the court. Persistence is part of what's expected of us. But they had a very narrowly defined test, if you will. So the court again defined that every religious belief can only be a preference or conviction. Now maybe you can think of some other type of, quote, religious belief beyond that. But that was all they would base their test on. And they defined the terms that they would judge by. But again, we got to remember this was 50 years ago. and the court and the society is different today. Well, they define preference. Preference is a very strong belief. It isn't the strength of your belief that makes it a conviction. Because some people, because of the strength of their belief, they make it their career. They go to work in the church. They become teachers. They become preachers. And they do it full time and they have a zeal for it. That's good. Some people give all their, everything they have to, quote, their church. All their time, all their money, it goes right there. But the court says that's not the deciding point. It's good to want to teach it to your children, but the court says all those things are good, just like the persistence was good, but will you change your beliefs, and with a change of belief, change your practices under certain circumstances? If you will change that belief under some circumstance, and if you change your practices to go along with those beliefs, if they will bend, if you will compromise, whether it's peer pressure, well, I want to get along with my friends, my group. I love you guys. You're my family. Remember that song that you used to hear, some of us? Give me that old-time religion. You know, it's good enough for mom and pop and grandma and grandpa. It's good enough for me. I just want to get along with my family. I want to get along with my friends. You know, peer pressure can be very strong, especially to people who are very socially oriented, that they need approval of others. And it might influence someone to change their religious beliefs and practices. Or litigation, to face a court. That's intimidating. And you know what goes with litigation usually? Is the media attention that goes with it. That can be more brutal than the courtroom. It's only bad. Or you can be threatened with jail. And the court says ultimately, maybe the ultimate question is, will you die for it, or will you do like Jesus said and compromise to save your life? No, didn't he say something like, he who will save his life in this world will lose it, but he who will lose his life for my sake and the gospel's sake will save it? That's pretty hard. But the court says that might be the ultimate proof that you can give us, that you'd be willing to die for your faith. Otherwise, if you'll compromise on any of those things, you've got a religious preference, and we're not going to protect that under this court system and this First Amendment. Mr. Gibbs, he says, you know, what would be worse, to die for your belief or to deny your faith and have to live with it? You know, some food for thought. So they went on to define a conviction. A conviction is a religious belief that you will not change no matter the cost. You've counted the cost. You're willing to take whatever the loss is to stand. To stand. See, they wanted clearly understood beliefs. They wanted clearly defined beliefs in your convictions. And they said, why would a person hold to a conviction unless they believe that it's something their God requires of them? It's God ordered. And how can you bend something that God demands, that God requires? How can you compromise unless you don't see God really is all that mighty? Maybe the court and jail and even death is mightier than God. Things for us to consider as we go into these latter days. How can we bend what God specifically stipulates? You know, it's not just a stubborn resistance to some evil system. There's some good out there, but there's a lot of evil in the systems around us. And it's easy to take umbrage and get up our ire and want to resist and fight back. I would say that we can stand firm in our convictions, but we can do it meekly and we can do it with respect. I think that's a very biblical approach to it as well. But the court found support for their definitions, and they found support for the tests they applied in three men. So we'll go back to Daniel and we'll talk about Rakshak and Beni. That's Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Their Hebrew names were Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. King Nebuchadnezzar changed their names to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and somewhere in our kids'
VeggieTales,
that word from? Adventures in Odyssey, VeggieTales, all these places. Anyway, it's cute, but what they went through is very, very enlightening. What the court could see in their experience is incredible. Daniel chapter 1. I better keep moving. So we had these Hebrew children that were taken to Babylon as captives of King Nebuchadnezzar, and some of them he chose out to be to learn how to serve him. And so there were four of them, Daniel and Shadrach and Beni, and they were given to one of the king's authorities. Verse 6, among these were Shadrach and Beni. Verse 7, to them the chief of the eunuchs gave names, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But Daniel, and we'll see in the context that not just Daniel, but all four of them, verse 8, purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself. And the court says, look, he says, your beliefs, your convictions were purposed in your heart. This was a determined decision that all four of them did that. And yet they handled it very politely and respectfully. They didn't get in the face, say, they didn't get up in arms. They didn't get nasty about it. They just says, please, let's try this. I want to protect your life, Mr. Eunuch, and I want to protect our lives. So yes, they purposed in their heart. You see, the court says that beliefs are not just something, I discovered this. It's very intentional. Very intentional. Then over in chapter 3 is the big story, isn't it? King Nebuchadnezzar built this golden image. This great, tall, golden image, and he wanted everybody to worship. So he called all the officials of the land, everybody with any authority, and he called them all, and he says, now look, when the music plays, everybody bow down and worship. He said, both bow down and worship my golden image when the music plays. And so the music played, and what happened? Here's Shadrach and Beni just standing up there, and everybody else kissing the dirt. Wow. Well, they had determined their beliefs. They had set their limits. And look what it says in verse 6 of Daniel 3. It says, whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. So they knew when they stood there how obvious they would be, and they knew the king's commandment. Three of them stood alone in that whole crowd, however big the crowd was. They stood alone. So the court said, if you require others to stand with you before you will stand, before you will take a stand, if you need some backup, if you're not willing to stand alone, then you have preferences and not convictions. If you can't stand on your own, now, we want to help each other, but there's times that we all comes down to answering for ourselves. So the court said, you'll be willing to stand alone no matter if anybody or nobody stands with you. Down in verse 15, Daniel chapter 3, verse 15. Amazing thing. So they were brought before the king, and the king was, man, boy, he was angry. He was upset. Verse 15, so the king says, now if you're ready at the time you hear this music and you fall down and worship the image, good. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into that furnace. And who is the God that will deliver you from my hands? Well, you know, they probably never seen God, but they could see that furnace. They knew what fire meant. They could see the anger of old Nebi. But it's interesting that the king, if you will, gave them a second chance. He broke his own law. He said, if nobody will bow down, you go into the furnace. And then he backs off and says, okay, you guys, because he liked them. He'd already promoted them in the kingdom and respected them, but he couldn't have this in front of everybody, that three are allowed to get away with this, when he already said. He broke his own law. You know, it's my carnal nature. I'd say, whew, I barely skated that one. I almost got briquette. Almost. But no, verse 16. But Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. We've made up our mind. Give us a second chance. Don't give us a second chance. Maybe there's no Supreme Court to appeal to. We've appealed to God, but we will not reconsider. Our faith, the court says, if your faith is negotiable, if you're willing to say, well, okay, I don't want to get fried. Maybe let's talk. What can I do? Can I get out of the crowd? What can I do to not get fried but not bow down? And if you try to find any way to work to compromise with your convictions, it's no longer a conviction. It's just a preference. I really want to stand up, but I'm scared. They should have been scared. They probably were. But faith, religious convictions are non-negotiable. There's no talking it over and find some happy medium. No, there's no acceptable middle ground. Verse 17. So the court went on. If this is the case, these guys talking to the king, if this is the case, our God whom we serve is able. They had confidence in their God, but they knew it was his decision. He is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. What a prophecy. They had no idea they were prophesying their own outcome. But they were just standing without bending. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the golden image which you have set up. See, the king says, this is it. You will or you won't. But they said, our God is able. But yet, even if he doesn't, we won't bow down. So the question in our minds is, have we considered? Are we willing to die to honor our God? People are facing that around the world right now. I hope we never do. I'm not speculating that any of us will ever face that. But it's a question. Our belief and our practices will not bend. Our faith stands firm. The court says, if we must be assured of victory before we take a stand, you know, if we got preconditions, I'm going to stand if. I'm going to stand when I'm confident that I'm going to walk away. So they said, that's just a preference. If you say, yes, I'm going to do it, but there's some preconditions that I expect to be in place before I will do it. And Mr. Gibbs made a good point. He asked, do we stand or are we just fighting for victory? I thought it was a good point. Are we willing to stand or we just want to fight against the evil just to get victory? Do we want to stand or do we just want to to win. He says, again, we need to be clear in our understanding. In our Christian faith, we do not fight for victory. He says, we fight already in victory. That's powerful. You see, we've already won before the fight ever starts. Now, whatever the fight might be, we're just standing in the victory that we already have, you and me, every one of us. We already have that victory. It's ours already. We're not fighting for victory. We're standing in that victory. He said, when Mr. Yoder faced his first trial and lost, he still won, didn't he? Because he appealed it. And in his appeal, he lost. He still won. So he appealed to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court says, okay, you're right. We agree. We can see the evidence. We've applied our tests of preference and conviction to you. And they pronounced him right. But he was right all along. And we must be right all the way along, whether we win or lose. Win or lose, we're right. A court does not tell us if we're right or wrong. We respect courts. We're subject to their decisions, unfortunately. And they do. They deliver their opinion. Again, I think that's a meaningful word. But we're right as long as we honor God and His Word. See, the court can't tell us we're right or wrong. Well, we can see that God knows our convictions, and He will see us through. Shadrach and Benny made their stand. Their convictions were very clear. The court said, then, you see what those three men were willing to do? There was that pattern of evidence, if you will, that Nebuchadnezzar had seen in his experience with those guys. First, with the food, and now in this place. Yeah, they got thrown in, but they walked out of that furnace, didn't they? The court says, how can the court know that you and I have a conviction? Do you and I know the difference between preference and the conviction? Okay, we believe we do, but how can the court know that we know the difference? You know, we're not there standing before that furnace ready to get thrown in, are we? Something else would be our challenge. So they say, the court, again, in their test, they said a conviction will always show up in our lifestyle, in our day-to-day life, how we live it out. It'll be evident. Pattern of evidence, if you will. What is on the inside will show on the outside. The evidence of our daily life reveals our hearts. What's really in there and what's grounded in there. The court said they can look at the outside and recognize that what's on the outside is there because of what's coming out of our hearts. What is on the inside? The court says we can't claim a conviction unless they can see that conviction lived and they can see it with some consistency, some evidence, you know, and that fits the scripture, doesn't it? What does James say? Faith without works is dead. You can have faith, but if you can't show me the works, it's empty. It's dead. So, what would your emotions be? What would your feelings be? What would your mind and your way of thinking be standing before a judge or before King Nebi? Are you standing firm? Are you confident? Might you be bold? Now, these three young men were sure bold before Nebuchadnezzar, weren't they? In their address, verse 6, Daniel 3:16, they answered the king and says, hey, Mr. Nebuchadnezzar. They didn't even call him king the first time. They did it later in the passage. They said, hey, you, Nebuchadnezzar, you need to hear what we have to say. I'm sure it was respectful. And yet, their first respect was to God, wasn't it? It's good to be bold in a right way. I'm sure they were fearful. I'm sure we would be. Were they awed? Not strange, but A-W-E, awe. Were they in awe to be called to stand and show their faith and their works? Were they eager? Probably not. But you read in the New Testament of some of the disciples who were eager to stand up and defend themselves before the court. Paul gave his defense before the king, and he says, I'm glad to be here today to give my defense. Others went in, and they were joyful when they were beaten and sent out. They were joyful that they were able to suffer for the name of Christ. What might your feelings be? Might you be relieved that finally we're going to get an answer to this that's been bothering me and bothering the world, and we're going to get an answer? Maybe there'd be an element of relief in it. I hope that there's an element of hope in it. I hope you're hopeful in such a situation. I doubt that we'd be too comfortable. It's just hard to imagine being comfortable. Even if we're confident and bold, maybe somebody would be. It's strange to me to think, but it's possible. It's possible. How would we feel there? And how are we feeling about our daily court where we're looking at ourselves and we know that God isn't judgment now on the house of God? God is watching us, our convictions and our actions based on those convictions every day. It's not the world's court. It's not the Supreme Court. And yet it has a far more eternal consequence, doesn't it? So the court wanted those facing the trial to explain their convictions and why they were convictions. And so they might ask, see, we want to see these convictions in our test. So you say, as a Christian, you have to come out of the world. Okay, show us how. In your daily life, you separate yourself from the world. And so they will look at what you do on your smartphone, what you do on TV, where you spend your money, where you spend your time. They want proof. You say, well, I'm a Christian and then I'm told to touch no unclean thing. Okay, what's unclean? Why do you call it unclean? And what do you do to keep yourself from the unclean? You say that this body is the temple of the Holy Spirit. Okay, are you taking care of it like it's... Show me, as a court, what you're doing to take care of the temple of your God's Spirit. God living in you. Are you taking care of this temple? So the court would pointedly inquire, where do you spend your time? Where do you spend your money? Where do you find your entertainment? What do you do? What can you show us in your life that we can rightly ascertain that you have a conviction? We're every day in court. We're every day giving our testimony and our evidence of our beliefs, the actions based on that. Do we live day by day in keeping with our convictions? Wow. Well, there were worthy lessons in the story to consider. I'll tell you, I was very disturbed as I read through that Supreme Court case from 50 years ago. And I know, in relative terms, it's not that long ago. And yet, reading through some of the reasoning of each judge that gives why they came to their decision, whether it was the judges that supported the decision or the dissenting judges, both sides, there was some strange, strange statements that these men and women put in writing, exposing themselves. This is how they think and this is how they judge. It was shocking to me. It was sobering. Mr. Yoder faced them, and in his case, and his friends, the other families, they overcame, they prevailed. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they stood. And they gave us a great story to blend the two together and to learn some lessons and to look at ourselves and where we're at. You see, you and I, each one of us, we will have a day in court. And that will be part two of this message. But right now, let's go to Daniel chapter 7. And now we will see about those, that fourth perverse beast and what happens there. That God has his court. Daniel chapter 7, verse 21 says, I was watching and the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them. So it's a tough time on God's people at some point. Until the Ancient of Days came and a judgment was made. So there's a court in favor of the saints of the Most High. See, God needs to judge us to know who's his saints and who are those that are just along as, well, I prefer to be with this bunch. Am I just doing this because I feel like I should be here? Or am I convinced and convicted I need to be with God and with God's people? The saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. You know, it's starting to sound like pretty good news, isn't it? Really good news. Verse 26. But the court shall be seated, and they shall take away his, that beast's dominion, and consume and destroy it forever. Verse 27. And then the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. And he will know by then who are the ones that he will give his kingdom to. Because he's tested us on a daily basis. He knows how we define our lives and our faith. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. And all dominion shall serve and obey him. You know, that's really, really good news. That court is really good news for us. And next time, we'll look deeper into that.